Hey everyone, welcome to the Transplant Strong podcast, also known as Danny Chats. This is episode number 44, and today I'm excited because I'm joined by Clodagh, who was living in Ireland, and she has had a bowel transplant. She's the first person that I've spoke to on this in this podcast that's had a transplant of the bowel. So yeah, it's very interesting. Hi Clodagh, how are you?
Hey Danny, I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you for coming
Good.
along.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Yeah. So what was the actual condition that you had that led to your bowel transplant?
So I was born with pseudo obstruction with intestinal failure, which is really, really rare. And basically, I had very poor like absorption in my stomach and well, my whole bowel, everything. And I was missing a layer of nerves in my gut, so and my peristalsis was affected. So it was kind of like several factors that were a part of that condition. So I guess if I go back to the very beginning, I was born in Cardiff, and I was I just at the first few weeks, I just constantly kept like vomiting, and they thought it was malrotation of my gut. So they did operation. Actually, they subsequently did two operations, and it was partly that, but then they discovered that that wasn't the full picture. So from around that same time as those operations, I was put on TPN, which is total parenteral nutrition. So they had hoped initially that that would just be like short term, so they kind of got everything, I guess, somewhat under control and understood a bit better what I had going
Yeah,
on.
the TPN, that's so you're having your food.
Sorry. So I have got my, it was all through an IV line. So it was like a
Yeah.
sterile procedure. And the line is like surgically inserted. I have a Hickman line. There's, I think, a few different variations, but Hickman line is a pretty permanent line. And then I was connected up every night. At that time, about 12 hours, about 12 hours a night.
Was this in hospital and at home?
So it started in hospital, and I was in hospital an awful lot. Like I always would say, hospital was my second home the whole way
Yeah.
through up. Probably still
Yeah.
is to a little extent, but thank God, not to the same
I'm sure a lot of
quantity of time.
people,
That I used
can
to attend.
relate.
Yeah, I bet they can.
Yeah.
So then at 6 months, I got transferred to Great Ormond Street, and that's in London. And that's where they were able to diagnose my condition. And that's when they did confirm it was pseudo obstruction with intestinal failure. So they had hoped that, well, they didn't really know because it was so rare, but they were hopeful at the time that I might outgrow it, or
Yeah.
ideally, I might need peg feed long term, but they hadn't. Didn't ho they had hoped it wouldn't be TPN long term, but anyway, I spent a lot of time in hospital, and I got off TPN completely between two and three, and I actually did really well in that year. Now I still couldn't eat or drink large quantities, but between a little bit and absorbing peg feeds really well, I did fine. And it was the end of that year, so I was kind of just coming up to turning three. I became quite unwell again. So I
Yeah.
was admitted into hospital, and I was in hospital then for about a year at that point.
Yeah. What's
And
Peg's feed?
oh, sorry. So peg is like a tube that goes directly into your stomach, or it kind of depends. I think people have them positioned differently. For me, it was went directly into my bowel, so it was avoided the digestion and the breakdown of food because they
Yeah.
knew, like, because my condition, I couldn't absorb, I wouldn't get all the nutrients like a normal person would as such
Yeah.
from food. And yeah, I did really well and all that, and I became quite unwell towards the end of turning three and the end of that year. And I was admitted back into hospital. I was in hospital for about a year, and I had to go back on TPN then. And again, they kind of like, you know, they hoped things would settle again. And I suppose at that point, there was probably no reason why they wouldn't, because I'd had a previous really good year. But that was the thing about my condition. It was so rare. There was many unknown factors.
Yeah.
So excuse me, they stabilized me and everything again, and I was discharged then. And at that point, we moved back to Ireland because my parents are from Ireland. And it's really weird. I was only saying this the other day to someone, but like I was the first person in the south of Ireland to go home on TPN as a patient.
Really?
And like that was like it was, I think, alien to many people at home that I was coming home in it. But like I guess that's how much it's advanced now. It's incredible, you know.
Yeah.
And that was my lifeline, and I ended up on that for 28 years.
Really?
Yeah.
So that must have been very restricting on, what you could do and planning, because how does it work? Do you have to have it at certain times every day? Can you just have it when you like?
No, so I guess I always think I was very fortunate in the sense that I didn't know any different. I don't recall that year that I didn't have TPN. So to me, it was like brushing my teeth. You just have to do it. And I think that was good in that regard. So I would just get on every night. And obviously, as I got older, like I was going to school. So it wasn't until I was about maybe 12, 11 or 12 that I started doing my TPN myself. Before that, like my mum would connect me or disconnect me, or my dad would, one of them would. So yeah, I would just get on at night time, I guess, and I would have it all through the night and then disconnect the next day and go to play school or college or whatever, wherever I was at like that stage. But I suppose like once things stabilized that time when I got discharged about four, I considering all, I was did really well for a number of years and like everything was very state like everything was very stable. TPN, my weight, my old condition, thankfully. And it was kind of, and I was still monitored really closely by Gray Ormond Street, and I was still over there every 6 months at least, and I'd kind of be in for a week, and I'd call it an MOT, but like I'd go in and out of every scan, and everything would be reviewed, you know. And then it was in my teenage years again that my condition just started to deteriorate a bit further, and at that time it was such early stages, but I recall the very first time I was mentioned in a ward around when they came around. One afternoon, and the team and they started talking about bowel transplants, and they were saying, you know, it's a really new development, but it's not something we wouldn't rule out. It's just something we need to like observe for a while yet. And the thought of that just terrified me. But it is incredible how much medicine in the whole has come on. Like it's amazing. So, and at that point as well, I was well enough that I didn't need it. And Birmingham were the only hospital that did peds bowel transplants at the time, and I'm not sure is that if that's still the case, but yeah, they were very far and few that were done, very very early days. And then I was under Gray Ormond Street till I was 18, and I then was transferred to adults, which is such an enormous adjustment, I think, if anyone's
I can,
experienced it.
definitely. From going from a child's ward to an adult's ward
It's a whole
is
other ball game.
traumatizing.
It really is. It is. Absolutely. So that was a lot. It was really hard, but we did it. And then it was sort of when I was about 23, 24, it was final year of college actually. So about 24, my condition deteriorated an awful lot. And I think at that point, although I was in denial, deep down I knew we were getting closer to the reality of me needing a transplant. Because like being on TPN, so I was on it for like, I mean, I depended fully on it. It was my lifeline, my HIC line. So like that can have an impact on your liver. And I did remarkably well to get 28 years, and still thankfully not need a liver transplant when it came to needing a transplant. But that and just vein access were, beside my condition deteriorating, were two huge factors that would really point to need in my case need, needed would point to needing a transplant, although obviously my condition was obviously deteriorating, so that was a massive factor in itself. So people need them for all different reasons, but I did really really well, and like it's thanks to TPN I got to that point. And it's weird because like I remember, you know, I did went to school, missed loads of school but kept going, and went to university, did loads of traveling, with friends and stuff, did show jumping. Like I never allowed to stop me, but I think, and it was restricting, it was so restricting at times. But as I said, I think the fact I didn't really know any different was also a blessing.
How did travel work in that time? Because you were having to, would you have
Nightmare.
to take all these bags with you?
The logistics, honestly, it was something else. So like you'd have to get all the medication pre-approved with airlines, and then most of the time, like the TPN would be delivered by the TPN company to the airport. And
Oh,
like I was
really?
on 4 liter bags. And so like they were enormous. So even going away for a week, the quantity of stuff, and that was just TPN. And at the back then I would like have pumps, and they were, I didn't have the little portable pump I got more recent years prior to my transplant. Like I they were like 10 kg pumps, and you'd have to always bring one, the two, in case one went kaboosh. And yeah, it took so much planning. And now that I don't have any of that, I'm like, how did we do it? Like, how did my mum do that with two other, like, there's three of us, you know?
Yeah. Three kids.
How did mum and dad do that? Yeah, it's amazing what you got to do, isn't it, when you just got to do it?
Yeah.
But in hindsight, I'm like, we must have been mental. But we did it.
Like, so, you yeah, say, if that's what you got to do, that's what you got to do.
Yeah. And, like, I'm so grateful it didn't stop us. And it didn't stop me as I got older and I went traveling with friends and stuff. But it took a lot. And I guess, like, final year of college, I went traveling for 3 weeks with, like, there were four of us in total. We went to, like, the West Coast of America. And that was really touch and go, literally, to the day we got to the airport, because the regulations and the pumps and approval. Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's got harder now. I don't know. But it took a lot. But yeah, it was amazing. And I'm grateful I was able to do it, you know. But it's and I remember back then, like, I'd often say to girls, imagine if I didn't have all this to bring with me when I went. Like, imagine what that'd be like. I just couldn't comprehend. And I was like, it would be the biggest dream come true. And I was so, so, so lucky and so grateful to receive that in November 2019.
Yeah, 2000. So just to go back, like, your parents, you know, were so good to encourage you to do all these things, because it can go one of two ways. You know, you could probably be very restricted as a parent and worry, and which is really understandable, you know. But the fact that they were taking you on holidays kind of probably prepped you for when you went away by yourself.
I was so lucky. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, they never allowed to stop me. And then I guess it meant I never allowed to stop me. Even when I was sick, I just keep plowing on. Maybe that wasn't always the brightest ideas back then. But yeah, I'm so grateful for that. You know, we were just like a normal family. Three of us loved each other some days, killed each other the next day, my brother, sister and I, you know. And I suppose it was really important for them as well. Like, you know, we had as normal a childhood as we possibly could, but I guess in our house that sometimes meant mum and I having to go back to the UK for longish since. But they weren't as long, thankfully, as when I was very little.
So you said that they mentioned that they mentioned the transplant, and then you had the transplant in 2019. So what was the time between there? So how long was that roughly?
So, like, the very, very first time was mentioned, I was really little. I was only, I'd say, 11 or 12 on Great Ormond Street. And I mean, I think it was only just started then in the UK. But at that point also, like, we had time on our side that we could hold off. Like, they said, you need a transplant now. You know, we were lucky we could hold off. And, you know, I always used to think, even when I was listed, like, for every transplant, someone has a transplant before me, it's another, like, I don't know, someone else, if you know what I mean, in that sense.
Yeah.
And, like, even, it's amazing how much in advance, but even I remember, so it was April. So that was about 10, 11. And that was just like, it was just kind of set in the background, kind of. And then it was really, again, in my late 20s, I suppose, maybe 26, 27, because I was actually 28 when I was listed.
Yeah.
And I came over. I had an Adam Brooks in Cambridge, and I came over for an assessment. I think that was probably about 3 weeks, the assessment. And that was so tough. Whoa, that was a lot. But thankfully, I was fine. You know, it's quite vigorous, because obviously they have to make sure you're a suitable candidate. And you know, with, I'm not sure if it's every transplant, with biotransplant in particular, though, it's about, like, you know, they want to list you when you're not ideally, and obviously this isn't the same for everyone, but ideally when you're not, like, critically unwell, but you are unwell, if that makes sense.
Because you need to be well enough to recover afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was very fortunate in that regard. So I had my assessment that April, and I guess the biggest query at that time was whether or not I'd need a liver, and that would have changed it all a lot for me because of my poor vein access and everything else. So thankfully that was a massive relief that I didn't. And also, obviously, you're dealing with such like an enormous organ overall in your body and stuff, that every additional organ you need, it's, you know, you can run into more complications on the other side. So it was that summer, I think 2019, we kind of like, it was kind of, we got the 100% go ahead and everything. And it was that November 19 I was listed. And it's really weird because I remember before I was listed saying, I really think, and people probably think I'm mad saying this, but I remember saying, I really think I'll get the call within a month. And on the 25th night, I got the call.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was mad. But I was really lucky. Again, some people are waiting months and months, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Was you already in the UK then, or was you back?
No. So I was living in Dublin.
Yeah.
And yeah, that whole experience was mad also. So I got the call, and it was all obviously planned out. But an ambulance then picked me up, and my brother actually, because he was living in Dublin at the same time, and brought us to Dublin Airport. And we were flown by air ambulance to Stansted. It was mad.
Yeah.
And then an ambulance at Stansted collected us and dropped us at Brooks. And my mum actually came from Cork. And then my dad came over the next day. So we were just very fortunate, like, that, well, there's very few flights go out of Cork City. So we were really, really lucky that one night I got the call, there was a late flight out to the UK.
Yeah.
Like, that was just, yeah, the timing of it all really couldn't have been better. And then so I got it, I think it was about, like, so I got the call about 9, and I was in Addenbrookes for about half 12 at night. It was
wow,
mad. Yeah,
so VIP efficient treatment,
honestly. Yeah. and then the next morning I was brought out to theatre, and my operation lasted 13 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how can you remember how you were after your operation when you came round?
So I was in ICU for a few days. I don't really remember that very well, but
groggy.
Then yeah, groggy. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember a lot of pain initially, but it was fine. And then, yeah, those 2 days really are quite a blur actually, the more I think about it. And then I was transferred to high dependency, and I did really well. And I was stepped down then from high dependency to the, transplant ward about 5 days later. And then I was in, I think, for maybe 6 weeks in total after my transplant, which was really good. And I think the team were pretty pleased with that as well, because that was so initially they kept me on TPN after my transplant just to give everything a chance and my body and everything to like, you know, to adjust.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of wound on and off TPN. And then I was like 2 nights out of TPN, and I was discharged New Year's Eve 2019.
What a lovely new year.
Yeah, it was so bizarre. I think I just didn't quite believe it when I was discharged that I was discharged, you know what I mean? It was,
yeah,
I think I suppose you wait for that moment and then you're like, oh my god, I'm out on my own now, I have to eat and drink. And as I said, it was something like I'd always wished for, but I underestimated actually how much of a challenge that could be. Suddenly I had to eat and drink, which I was so restricted up to that point. So that took some time for me to kind of figure out. And that sounds mad, I know.
Yeah, that's not something that, you know, you generally think about.
No, not at all.
But yeah, because so how did that work then? Was you just sort of taking things slowly and seeing what you could eat, what you couldn't eat, or?
Yeah, and like there's only 3 foods you can't have that can interact with the immune suppressants, but otherwise, you know, you keep away from fermented foods or raw foods.
Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of a given really.
So
otherwise there was no restrictions, which was great, and I kind of thought that it'd be quite a criteria, but it wasn't. And yeah, it was just that, it was just, yeah, just trying testing. And my taste buds changed an awful lot. Like before my transplant, I would crave savory things all the time, and I didn't know what having a sweet tooth was like. I have developed a sweet tooth since, but yeah, unfortunately. So that was all quite a new concept for me.
Yeah. Was there anything that was like your go-to food for a while?
I always feel I'm going through phases of food. I think pancakes, probably one. One thing I couldn't get enough of, which was so funny thinking about it now, prior to my transplant, I always liked grapefruit.
Yeah.
And then when I was told like I couldn't have grapefruit going forward, I honestly took the biggest craving to them from when I found out to when I got the call. It was mental. Like, yeah. It was so weird. So that's a really, like, probably what I remember prior transplant. But after, no, I feel like I just the way I am, I often crave different foods. But I think pancakes was probably my go-to initially. But I think, too, it's just because they're quite easy to digest.
And, yeah, and they're tasty.
Yeah. But yeah, so that brought me up to like January 2020. And I was doing really well, as I said, and just adjusting to that. And it was really weird also, like that lifeline that was like my safety net. And like without that, I wouldn't have got that point. And like it just suddenly not to be tempted on it was incredible. Yeah. And it's weird because even now, if I have a super early start or like, you know, getting up really early to go for a flight or something, I would, the night before, I'd be like, oh my God, automatically, I'd be like, what time do I need to get on to get off the next day? Like, that's how programmed and that's how used to my life was. Like, it had to be quite organized regards that.
It was the majority of your life, really.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. I'm only coming up to 4 years post, like, without TPN.
Yeah.
It's mad. It's so cool. And then that end of that January, because that early February, I unfortunately ran into a difficulty and I ended up with rejection. And that was really scary, really scary. But thankfully, we got through that and that was fine. And then that March again, I was just back in for like a follow-up scan and I had rejection for the second time. And that was actually probably seems weird to hear, but I didn't find it as scary as the first time because I think I somewhat knew a bit better what to expect and the process. And I wasn't actually as unwell the second time as I was the first time. But that brought us then up to the pandemic.
Yeah. So when you were going through those bouts of rejection, what was the procedure for, keeping you on track?
So I was on IV antibiotics and also the first time around, high courses of IV steroids.
Yeah.
And I think that from what I recall the first time, they repeated that course twice at least. And all looked great, all looked fine and everything. Because with the biotransplant, the only way you can like really tell in relation to if there's rejection or anything is to do biopsies.
Yeah.
There's no bloods or anything like that. But that all looked like well, like it was had turned the corner, it was recovering. And then as I said, it was just a couple of weeks later, I was just brought back in for a follow-up biopsies and stuff, and that's when further rejection occurred.
Yeah. Devastating.
Yeah, it really was. I think like, you know, for any of us that are transplant recipients, it's like rejection and infection are the two things you just hope will never be faced with.
You know,
so within the first few months, that was, well, at any time, no one wants to face it, don't get me wrong, but in the first few months to get that twice was heavy going, for sure, you know.
But, you know, for people that see this, you know, I think it's not common for people to go into rejection, but I do hear a lot of people that do and they make it through okay. Hmm. I think the doctors see it as just kind of standard procedure and, you know, they're we'll do this, we'll do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And also with the triple transplant I had, like I remember when I went over for the assessment initially, you know, they said we kind of say to all our patients a minimum, and obviously some people get out far quicker than this and for other people not as quick, but they kind of say we tell all our patients we expect to be in hospital between 3 months and a year. Yeah. And that's just like every individual is so different. And I think everyone that goes forward for it's put forward for bowel transplant too are all for incredibly different reasons. So no one's, and they always say that they're like, no, you know, no one's journey is the same. It's like everyone's on their own path with it. But yeah, it was really scary. But like I have the most incredible team. They are just fantastic and they're just so kind and just so cool, calm, and collected when you're literally having an internal breakdown. But that means so much when you're a patient and you're terrified, you know?
Yeah.
And they are incredible. They still are. They're amazing. So I'm so, so grateful for them. And yeah, they definitely made it all a bit easier. But yeah, it's scary. But as we said, some people will go a whole life and never face rejection, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a reason why someone does versus doesn't. It's just.
I remember when I was a few months out and I was still having regular checks. I went to the hospital and I had some bloods done and the doctor rung me up and he said, some of your bloods are just not looking quite right. And I was like, okay, so what does that mean? And he's like, oh, it might mean that you're just going into rejection. We'll see you next week. Bye. And like hung up. So I'm just there like, oh wow, this is great. Yeah, terrifying. But luckily for me, luckily for me, it was fine. But doctors can be so matter of fact about it. Like, yeah. Oh, it might just mean you're going into rejection. We'll see you next week.
No biggie.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Oh my God, I know, yeah. And I guess it's hard because for them, not that it makes it easier for us as patients sometimes, and my team are not like this at all, but I think for some, it's so like their norm every day.
Yeah, yeah, so matter of fact about
yeah, them. Whatever team might be under, and you're like, this isn't my norm, or not what I anticipated.
Yeah,
but it's kind of, yeah, sometimes you just have to laugh, don't you? You have to see the humour in them, absolute madness.
Definitely. No. Oh, if you didn't laugh, like you say, you'd just be crying.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah. That was my experience transplant. And like I've done so well. And I suppose what I forgot to say is, you know, some people when they have a multivisceral bowel transplant, they might need everything transplanted, like including their stomach, duodenum, liver. I was really fortunate, so I had, I guess, the most straightforward of an incredibly complex transplant, if that makes sense. So I had my small bowel, my colon, and my pancreas transplanted, and obviously that was great in the sense that like the less good organs, the less complicated.
Yeah, because we've spoke before, and you said you had two pancreases.
Yeah. So I often mean to ask them more about this, but from what I recall, sorry, they're telling me at the time, they give you two because it's always to do with the plumbing.
Yeah.
That just seems mad. I'm like, yeah, where does that fit? But yeah, two pancreases, but I think all multivisceral patients do.
Yeah. And in terms of, because like I say, you're the first sort of bowel patient I've spoke to, in terms of the operation, because, you know, liver transplant, it's kind of either an L or the Mercedes cut, as they call it. How did they go about doing yours?
You know what? It's incredibly neat. It's incredible. It actually blows my mind how neat it is, considering like what they must be going on in there when they're trying to transplant you. It's literally just a straight line right down the center of my tummy. Yeah.
And it healed fine, everything okay?
Yeah, and it's so neat. It's far neater than after many other scars I have from many other operations. As a kid, yeah, it's mad.
Yeah.
But it's so neat, yeah. And yeah, I was really lucky that all healed really well, you know?
Yeah. And so what's that led you? What are you up to nowadays then?
So now I am, so I had gone back. So I initially did a degree in food business and marketing. And I worked in that for a few years, but I figured that kind of wasn't for me. So I went back to do psychotherapy, but then I had to defer for some time when I got my transplant and stuff. Yeah. So I got back to college last year and I finished that. So I graduated at the end of last summer, which is great. And I, thank you. I was, at one point I kind of wondered, what have I done going back? Because having had to take 2 years out, the shock of going back to college was one thing, but the shock of going back into final year was a whole other ballgame.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have, I don't think I could ever prepared myself for how hard it was, but that was probably just as well. I didn't realize how tough it would be. So I did that, and then I haven't actually started working in that area yet, because another thing that I had wanted to do, but I kind of wanted to get the psychotherapy sorted first, was set up my own travel business.
Yeah.
So I started that at the beginning of this year, which is really exciting and obviously completely different, but I always knew I wanted like a complete contrast of two things in the long run. So I am like an independent travel agent. So like I'm a home-based travel agent, basically.
So how do we book a holiday from you?
Follow the Instagram page.
What's your Instagram?
It's Escape Travel.
Escape Travel.
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, I'll put a link to that in this video.
Oh, you're so good. Thank you.
Everyone deserves a holiday. So.
Oh my God. Yeah. If you get talking to me, you'll be convinced anyway, because I'm always booking the next the next thing. So and I love that, and it's great because there's such flexibility with it, and you know, it just works. It just works really well for me.
Do you get to travel because of that?
I get to travel a good
bonus.
Yeah. So a big bonus. Yeah. That was a big part of what drew me into it. So yeah, it's great. So I am doing that, and I'm just trying to figure out kind of what route I'd like to go down with our psychotherapy side of things.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to actually work in that area. As I said, I'm just not quite sure exactly whereabouts within it I want to, but I loved my training. Like, it was hard. It's an incredible personal journey you're brought on, but so insightful, and I think like it really stood to me so much with everything I've been through the last few years, you know.
Yeah, I was gonna say, did that help you in any way?
Yeah, it really did. And like just the whole work around trauma, and like, obviously part of our training we have to do a lot of therapy, which makes sense if you're going to be bringing clients on that journey. And obviously after my transplant and everything, I'm a real advocate for therapy. I think it is incredible, you know, and I've done lots of work around trauma and everything myself since it all, and yeah, it's helped me hugely. So it's really, it's hard, but it's like, it's really, really rewarding work.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to get that going.
Oh, so sorry. You can obviously have your sessions and help people, and then you can book them a holiday for afterwards.
Someone was saying that to me recently, actually. Yeah. Win-win.
Yeah. What I think you need is this holiday to Mexico for 2 weeks.
You'll have to sort out all your problems. So that's kind of, I guess there are two things I really, really enjoy, and I hope with the psychotherapy side of things, I'll be able to bring stuff to it, considering everything, you know, because I think we're all on different journeys for different reasons. I do believe that, and I think if we're lucky enough to kind of find something we really enjoy, then it's fantastic, you know.
Yeah,
a way of giving back.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of transplant patients, when they have been through their transplant, they seem to go into jobs that they're really passionate about, because
it's interesting you say that, because I think it's really true though. And I think also, like, you know, when you've been through what the likes of you and I have been through, you're so grateful for the smallest of things. And I think like, we just maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's not, but like, I know maybe I'm just talking to myself when I say this, but you know, just don't settle for just something you're like oh, there's no point, because I think we really know what hard days are like, and I think we really cherish the good days then. And
yeah,
we're also grateful, I guess, that we're still here thanks to a very selfless donor and their family. Yeah. You know, so yeah, it's funny you say that, but I definitely think it's a really valid point.
Did you have the opportunity to reach out to your donor's family?
Yeah, you know what, I actually did that a couple of years ago, just before I turned 30. It was something I really wanted to do. I have no idea if they received it or opened it or anything, but I would love for themselves, even if I never hear anything, that they would, and I'd hope it would give them a little bit of peace.
Because
I don't think that there will never be enough words to describe how grateful I am.
Definitely not.
At all, you know, because like, oh my God, I can't imagine what a hard decision it is in the hardest of times.
Yeah.
And to have to make a call. But yeah, I did. Did you?
Yeah, I did write a letter. I haven't heard anything back. I think it's been over a year now.
Yeah.
But how did you find that process? Because it took me a long time to write my letter, and it took me quite a few attempts to figure out what I was going to say.
I feel like I thought about it for so long before I ever put pen to paper. But so I guess I was clear enough on what I wanted to say. No, I did, like, once I started typing or writing, whatever I did, I definitely scrapped a few and went again, but it was easier for me, I think, than I expected, it because I had given it so much thought before. And it was something I was like determined I was going to do before I turned 30, because I wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for that him or whoever my donor may have been. So I know I'll think about their family so much, and I often wonder, did they ever, but you know, you never know what they're going through, or they could receive lots of letters if lots of organs were received from that.
Yeah, that's very true. I've never thought about that.
Yeah, so to be fair, that's also, I'm sure, a lot if you're on the receiving end of all that, you know.
Yeah. Well, it took me, I think I said 3 years to write my letter. So I kind of wasn't expecting something back straight away. It might take them time. And
absolutely, yeah, exactly. And I actually have only heard of one person I know that did hear back from their donor family. And I think an awful lot of recipients do write at some stage. You know, there's no right or wrong when you do it or if you do it. Yeah. But
I know people that have met up with the families.
Yeah,
and
I don't know anyone in particular, but you definitely hear those stories. God, that must be a really surreal experience.
Kind of like family.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, I never thought about it that way, but yeah. Like, I never thought about the meeting up part, you know, but yeah, you definitely hear it.
Yeah. So to conclude, what would be your sort of number one tip top two tips maybe for someone that's going through the transplant process and how to maybe stay strong when it feels like it's all getting on top?
I think like the first thing is probably that it's really normal to feel every emotion under the sun.
Yeah.
And it's really hard, but it's to kind of roll with it. And you know, if you're sad, you're sad, if you're cross, you're angry. That's all really normal, because I think we're quite accepting when we have to go through it because we don't have another option. But I think the enormity of it all, in my case anyway, it's like it didn't really hit me till probably a year after.
That's how I felt. Yeah.
Was it? Yeah. And then that was weird because it was still in the thick of COVID.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think there's any right or wrong way about that whole process, but I think that's really normal. And I think the other thing is, I remember a therapist saying this to me and it just really resonated at the time. You know, like, it has been the greatest gift I could ever have hoped for. But also it's kind of normal to, and this sounds really weird, but it's also sort of normal to grieve what you don't have anymore, because that's what some of us have been so used to for more of our lives than we have been post-transplant.
Yeah.
You know, and like, it does get easier. It does. And I still have little rough patches here and there, but you know, like, you definitely cherish the good days, you know?
Yeah, I think.
What would yours be?
Well, post-transplant, I think kind of like what you were saying about, you know, accepting that there's going to be mixed emotions and not beating yourself up about if you're feeling down or if you're feeling like it is on top of you. But after your transplant, you know, like you said, I mean, it was like a year down the line for me that it kind of all hit me. And it's like, again, you know, having, you were saying about being very grateful for having the opportunity to have your transplant.
Yeah.
And then you have days where you feel down or you don't feel so good about yourself and all of this. And you kind of like, I should do because I've had this extra chance. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you shouldn't beat yourself up for feeling down, you know, and having
like
rest days.
We're trying our best, and so, some days it is a lot.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
But it's okay, and some days I think it's easier to see that, and some days it's a lot harder to comprehend. But I think it's all part of the process, you know.
Yeah. I think because like you say, we are grateful every day, but we don't.
Oh my God, absolutely.
We don't always have to like show.
Yeah, I think. You can be really grateful, but it can still be a hard day for whatever reason, you know.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean you're not grateful, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. It just means it's a sharp day.
Yeah. And it still happens. So
yeah.
And it's allowed to happen.
Yeah. I think they're probably the two things.
But here's to many good days.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Thank you so much for chatting to me. It's been really interesting.
Not at all. Thank you so much. And I hope sharing my story will help someone else that might be on their journey or about to commence.
Yeah. I mean,
it's incredible.
I've done 43 videos, and like I say, you're the first bowel,
the bowel
transplant. So, but I've seen all the videos, but they're going through that situation. At least there's another angle for people to appreciate.
And there's only about, the year I had my transplant, 2019, they did between 10 and 12 a year. So they're still such a tiny minority, really, when you think of how frequent kidney transplants are done, or liver or pancreas,
this is very valuable in that sense, because for me as a liver transplant patient, you can go on Instagram, you can type in liver transplant hashtag, and there's quite a few people that have had them, and you can reach out to these people and you can find out about their experience. But if it's even harder to find someone that's had that transplant, and
that's it.
So at least, having this out there, it's hopefully going to be a resource for people.
Because God, I'd give anything back, because I've been so fortunate to meet the kindest and the nicest people on this. And you're not alone, and sometimes you feel you are, but you're really not,
And for also people, not just transplant patients, but people that are dealing with your condition, to see how you are still, or parents of, that have got children with that condition, to see how you still managed to live your life, you still managed to go to college, you still travelled, could be very reassuring for someone. So I really appreciate it.
Not at all. And it's kind of, I guess, to show we don't have to be defined or restricted, as restricting as it might be, and that's all part of the game. But thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. I'll let you get on with your day now.
Thanks, Danny. Have a good
night. See you later. Bye-bye. Bye.